Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Nucleus Investment Insights. I'm Shelley, Head of Operations at Nucleus Wealth, and I'll be sitting in Tim's MC chair for another week while he's on holidays. This week we have special guest Patrick Ceresna joining us live from Barbados to take a deep dive into what market pricing is telling us about the current macroeconomic environment and how we should be positioning portfolios for this. Patrick is founder of and chief derivative market strategist at Big Picture Trading Incorporated. His focus is the trading world, where we are hoping to get some insights, but he also keeps a keen eye on the world of macroeconomics. Patrick is the host of not one, but two podcasts, being the Macro Voices podcast, which does a weekly deep dive, typically into the more fundamental questions of the macro environment, and the Market Huddle podcast, which also is also a weekly deep dive, but into trends of more of a trading focus. Patrick, thanks for taking time out of your evening to join us, and welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to an hour of fun with you guys.
So are we. Thank you. And also joining us today for our deep dive into markets is Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hi, Damien.
Hi, Shelley.
Okay, so a bit of housekeeping before I jump into the agenda and then the show. So I'm really delighted to announce that we've passed 3,000 subscriber milestone on YouTube. So thanks to everyone who subscribed so far. If you haven't and would like to, hit that subscribe button. Click the notification bell if you'd like to be notified when we go live or have a new webinar to watch. And hit the like button if you want to help our show grow. Or also, of course, if you're like me and love podcasts, you can follow us on your preferred podcast platform. Okay, to the agenda. It's jam-packed today, but to highlight a few of the things we'll be looking at, bubbles, running off the back of our show about Bitcoin last week. We can find out Patrick's thoughts about that. We'll also be talking about equity market rotations, USD pricing, option pricing, and its portfolio uses. So on that note, I'll hand over to you, Damien.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Shelley. We might start. Patrick's got a few slides for us. I was hoping sort of maybe to get a little bit of background, I guess, on what you're, I guess, the last few months and what you're seeing, so that just for perspective of how you're looking at the current rally and how sustainable it is and how much of a where you're seeing markets sort of travel from here.
Well, you know, when I look at the markets today, obviously there's no shortage of incredibly strong opinions by all sorts of people as to whether this is one big stock market bubble or whether this is just the beginning of a new bull market that is coming off of that COVID crash that happened in 2020. And for me, I really look at this market from the perspective that the excesses of the bull market in the prior bull market never were really worked off. And in fact, the very quick intervention by central banks to flood the system with liquidity just actually contributed to amplifying even more bubbles and created more places that we can run into all sorts of problems moving forward. What's interesting is that we have now reached a point in the markets where the sentiment has become almost definitively bullish, to the point that everyone has almost thrown in the towel on being bearish. There's only the hardcore bears are bearish, the ones that will never yield. And that sentiment has really shifted. And so on one of page five of the chart book, where I have the S&P 500 performance in the post-November period, there's also a small graph there on the sentiment in the market. This is using the Nomura research model, where they look at everything from market breadth to volatility to put call ratios to all these different things. And their readings on sentiment have now reached the 98th percentile going back to 2004. And it's just such a strong positive sentiment that everyone's so convinced this market's going to keep going. And yet there are so many warning signs in terms of what, you know, that things are going to hit some sort of a roadblock somewhere here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I'll tell you where we're coming from as well. We're one of the bears who threw the towel in and basically went, look, we took this view that the big thing we're going to have to concern about is whether bankruptcies actually start back up again, and with the big debt burdens and sort of overlaying. But we're sort of taking the view that the liquidity now has just overwhelmed that, and the amount of government support and everything with a new light at the end of the tunnel in terms of the vaccine. Once we got all these positive vaccine results, it's like, well, if bankruptcies weren't going to happen in the first 6 months of COVID, then now that we can actually see a light at the end of the tunnel, they're going to get extended again and again until we sort of reach when the final reckoning is, who knows? But so we're sort of in that camp about saying, okay, we've thrown the towel in on the bearish part. We're still watching for scenarios that might actually pop up to give us that to sort of put us right back into the bearish camp. But what I guess I'm most interested in is if we're on that path, what are the things we should be watching for to say, okay, the markets are starting to turn and maybe they are getting nervous, and you know, so where are the downside things that you're looking at, I guess, from a trading perspective?
So my view actually is not too much different than yours, actually. And I don't actually think I want to be labeled thinking that there's going to be a full-on bear market in like a format of something like a 2008 event. I mean, there has to be a lot of things that line up for one of those prolonged bear markets. It's really about the fact that the stock market has really reached a very large excess on the upside, and markets always mean revert. When everybody is so convinced that the market is going higher, then the impulse is, it exhausts all of the buying pressure, and inevitably there's going to be a sell cycle that ensues on the other side. And so that doesn't have to develop into a negative feedback loop that creates that asset deflation cycle that just destroys stocks and equities over a 6 to 9 month period. But you're right about the bankruptcies being a concern. This particular recession is one of the most interesting, and it will be something that will be studied for many years, because it never followed the traditional analog that would be the recession bear market that we've seen in the past. And I would speculate that one of the reasons that was the case is because this recession was actually triggered by the governments, versus a lot of other recessions and bear markets of the past were market excesses that didn't have the governments and the central banks reacting quick enough that created those asset deflation cycles that would ensue on the other side. But here, the COVID shutdown was a government-induced event, which created massive spikes in unemployment and huge contractions in GDP almost instantaneously. And the governments knew that they had to offset that by immediately injecting the liquidity. So we had this amazing event that happened that do you know of any period in history where we saw something play out like this? This is unprecedented in terms of what we're going through, and it's going to be really interesting to see whether or not they can just perpetually feed it higher and higher from here.
Yeah, that's right. It's the liquidity versus fundamentals argument, isn't it? I mean, I do think there are, like, I mean, we sort of look a fair bit at deep dive in terms of companies, and there are certainly a number of companies we've been looking at, and I think it's probably broader than most people would think, where the profit results, I think, are actually going to be pretty good, because what's happened is you've had this sudden shock, and everyone's just gone, oh, I need to clear out all my deadwood. I need to fire my middle management that aren't doing anything that I just didn't get around to, and you didn't have the impetus. And so people went through and really cut costs wherever they could see it. And then, so when sales bounce back, I don't think they actually need to bounce back to 100% of where they used to be before you get the profits back to the same level. And so I sort of, on one side, I've got that positive side, and the flip side is, like, there's just this massive debt overhanging though that's still concerning in terms of, but if governments aren't going to let companies go broke, then or they're going to, you know, they've changed all the rules so that bankruptcies don't have to happen. How long can we carry that on for? And it could be a long time.
Well, you know, the thought that I have that makes me ask the question how this plays out. Like, for instance, when you go back to the 2008 financial crisis in the U.S., real estate peaked out over a year or more before the financial crisis, and initially. We saw, for instance, subprime mortgage companies starting to blow up through early 2007 and things starting to happen, the stock market just kept going and making higher highs, and it didn't seem to care. But it really was when it transitioned into a solvency issue a year later that it really started to create the crisis. And so the thing is that we still really don't know what the real impact of businesses have been. I mean, we can only speculate, but I think that there's going to be solvency issues that can't necessarily be fixed with liquidity. Now, there's going to be, I think, in this rotation, companies that are going to thrive in this new environment, especially those online businesses that are providing. There's going to be a change in the consumer behavior, and so there's going to be some companies that are going to be doing great. But then there's a whole wave of companies that will never recover. And though I believe that the Fed will provide, let's say, liquidity to the high yield markets if there was a liquidity crisis, I do not think that they're going to be bailing out zombie companies. There's going to be a period where companies that shouldn't be functioning are going to be allowed to fail. But does that mean there's going to be a bear market? I don't know about that one. But I certainly think that there's something that still has to play out in the coming year or two that has that a lot of people are sort of sweeping under the rug and trying not to look as to what could happen. But I still think that this COVID stuff, there are companies like, you know, I'll give an example. Like when I'm from Toronto, even though I'm in Barbados right now, there are restaurants that easily could survive the first 3 months of the COVID shutdown, because in the end, the government sent everyone the banks provided all sorts of lines of credit backed by the government to allow them to keep their doors open or to keep their businesses going. But now we're a year later. You know, like, there's a point where these restaurants are still closed. How long will these owners just keep trying to keep things going before they put the closed for business sign on the door? And these are things that I don't know how to truly size up, but I don't think it's fully played out yet.
Can I ask a question? Damien, you've talked a lot about these zombie companies and the concern about pushing out bankruptcies is that then they start to infect other companies. So, Patrick, do you think central banks and governments might not bail out the zombie companies, but might they do some ring fencing to stop them infecting other companies, some sort of payments or will honor this or something like that?
Well, it will be at the highest level, which is that as, let's say, default rates in the high yield market start to spike, it's going to force the credit spreads on high yield junk bonds to start to widen over that of treasuries. And so you're going to see that that the liquidity in the junk bond markets are going to become more scarce, and especially what would happen then is that it'll be very hard for these companies that still can keep their doors open to find that financing. And that's where they'll provide the liquidity. They're going to come in there, and that's what they've been doing all along, is they've been bailing out the market every single time. But they will let the zombie companies fail. I don't think we still are in a capitalist world. I don't think there's a benefit to keeping all companies going. It's just how it's going to play out. They will definitely bail out and provide liquidity for those companies that need that money.
But it sounds like also that it's at the high end of town and not necessarily the SMEs.
I think that in the transition to the new paradigm, like we're in a new period where almost, I think that there's new consumer habits developing. I think that even when they start to open shopping malls and everything and people come back, the trend toward online shopping now is being built into habits, right? People are starting to get used to having things delivered to them. And I don't think that that will go back to normal. So there's certain businesses that are just going to fail, and other businesses have to be restructured. Companies that relied heavily on being there at the consumer level and with brick and mortar, we're going to have to move far more to an online model. And so there's a transition phase that's going to happen. And there's going to be some companies that are going to fail to make that transition.
Yeah, and I think as well, there's obviously those companies out there that you're speaking about being given all these deadlines, and we've seen similar things in Australia and the US as well, for that matter. Yeah. If you're a company that was earning, you know, it was roughly break even, and you had a debt burden, and so you're surviving, and then you've had this crisis hit, and now even if you get back to that roughly break even perspective before debt, but now you've got this huge debt burden to, you know, you've doubled your debt in the meantime. It's yeah. Yeah, it's created a much harder situation for you going forward. But in terms of what you're looking at, so is it the high yield debt markets? Is that where you're sort of trying to focus? To where are we going to start seeing problems that these problems are arising and that we're going to, that this might start creating an
issue?
Well,
I mean, the most obvious thing is the froth and the bubbles stocks, and you know the. Air of easy money is so prevalent right across the world, as you can chase all these, whether it's solar stocks or EV stocks, and even now the commodity stocks, some of them have really kind of joined the party. But there, these stocks have been running, and that air of easy money is there as speculators are leveraging up to chase this return. And almost all parabolic rises at some stage, run too far, too fast. And once they exhaust themselves, the mean reversion creates a huge psychological sentiment shift that then spills over. And so I think right now, all of these markets are benefiting from that tailwind, because, for instance, the high yield bond market has a strong correlation to equities. It's very rare for us to see, like, even though treasury bonds right now are selling as yields are spiking, high yield bonds haven't really budged very much. And that's largely because of their they have that correlation to equities. It will need a turn in equities for high yield, or at least maybe the high yield will start to lead the equities. We'll see this time around whether they act. Usually the equities turn first, but I think that high yield is way overpriced as well, right?
Absolutely. And so maybe that's a good time, Jaden, for the Tesla Bitcoin chart, if you wanted to talk through that a little bit, Patrick. Is that a good entry into that?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And that's on page 7 of that chart book. And it just really shows. I marked the March low just to show, like, from the crash lows of the coronavirus, just how these have basically, the Bitcoin and Tesla have just been the story stocks. And I'm not going to get into a rant whether Tesla's a fraud or not. But I do know that the automotive space is an incredibly competitive market. And there are a lot of car companies that are coming up with some pretty sexy electric cars that are going to be competing in this space. And the edge that Tesla had is going to be narrowing.
Currently worth, is it more than every other car company put together, or is it something
else? Something like that. The way I look at it is that the market cap of General Motors and Ford combined is just over $100 billion, and Tesla is now 8 times larger than those two car companies combined. They're great cars, but there's a point when this is just outright stupid. It's no other way to put it. There, it's just at this stage, I love the term that in economics where they call it a Giffen good, and you would all know that because both Canadian and Australian real estate has a Giffen good element to as well, which is that higher prices beget higher prices because everybody sees and wants the performance that they perceive as being delivered there. And so the higher Tesla goes, the more buyers it is attracting because it's put to the forefront of everyone and everyone wants the more of that same performance. And it becomes a positive feedback loop that drives and has nothing to do. The whole point of bubbles is that it has nothing to do with fundamentals. It has nothing to do with logic or any rational thought. It's just the nature of how we investors are chasing performance and wanting to have a piece of that action, and that's what we're seeing in these markets with this, is that these stocks are just running and there's no fundamentals anymore. And you know, I don't even want to try already call a top on this. Who knows? Tesla might be at $1,000. You know, I mean, I think it was Kathy over that arc was suggesting some absurd level that would have had price target that would have had Tesla trading as a $6 trillion market cap. And like, gosh, I nearly fell out of my seat when I read this shit. And so it was, it's just, there's a point where this will exhaust itself. And when it does, it's going to shift the sentiment of the whole market. I really do believe it. And that's where some sort of deeper correction in the markets. I don't want to call it a bear market and crash, but it will be some very deep mean reversion in the markets from all of these excesses.
Mm. And so in the latest sort of, I guess, switching tack, in the latest sort of run up, it's been sort of very much carried by the value stocks. And I guess our take, I guess most people's take, is that this is a classic sort of reflation trade. Yes. Inflation starts to tick up. Bank shares then rally as the yield curve starts to rise, and you're sort of starting to get into this whole recovery as inflation returns to normal, and so the value stocks tend to perform. Given value sort of underperformed for such a long time beforehand, what are you seeing in terms of this trade? As to have we already seen it? Was November the, you know, you either missed November and you missed the value part, or do you think this is, if we don't see the markets start to get concerned about the debt that, you know, government's managed to keep holding that on, how much further do you sort of see this value growth disconnect going?
Well, growth stocks and tech stocks generally are the longest duration assets, and so they themselves have a sort of a long bond element to them. So whenever you have a yield curve steepening, we could talk about that on some of these charts. That typically is a headwind for those growth stocks, and that's truly a period where you could see a lot of the cyclicals and value start to outperform. That doesn't necessarily mean that those growth stocks have to be losing money. It's just about relative outperformance, right? And I yes. think that that we're going to see a period where, if in fact we have seen the beginning of a reflation trade that may sustain for years to come, even though I think it's gotten way ahead of itself on the very short term, if it's has rotated, it's a multi-year trend, and this wouldn't be just over a couple months in. And, you know, on page 6, I have the Russell over NASDAQ. Now, Russell's small caps, not necessarily. I mean, you could argue that there's a lot of value inside the small caps at this stage. But
it's probably similar trade.
Yeah, it's very similar in terms of its correlation. And so we've seen it. I didn't go far enough back here, but for 3-4 years, this has been in a huge downtrend. And we're finally seeing it turning up. And it's funny, but the chart looks almost identical to the yield curve on the 2s 10s as we see the steepener kicking in that's really has a direct correlation here. And so I don't think it's over. I think that a lot of the cyclical stocks that have really run a lot of, especially a lot of these kind of resource names that have really run, have probably gotten ahead of themselves on the short term, are due for a correction. But I do believe that a major commodity bull market, we were long overdue for one. And I think that it's pretty clear that we have begun one. And it's just the question is it time to buy right now? It's probably a little bit late to start chasing today.
Well, as I want to come back to that one, but let's before we get to the commodity side. So in terms of the I guess there's one of the things which you could see the markets getting concerned about is if interest rates get too high in terms of this yield steepening we're talking about. And actually, I should take one step back for people. What Patrick's talking about with the twos, tens is the 10-year bond minus the 2-year bond. So it gives you sort of an idea about how steep the bond curve is. When it's really low is usually when people are expecting poor economic conditions and long-term rates to remain low. And when it starts to steepen, people are expecting things to get better in the future. And so
I have a good chart of that on page 13. And so you and more importantly, this goes all the way back to 1991. And so you can really see amplified these cycles where we've seen the steepening and flattening of the curves and the impacts that they have. It really impacts portfolio allocation, and these trends last for years. And so this is not about day trading or even swing trading. This is what you can identify key shifts in the cycle. It impacts the way you construct a portfolio.
Can you guys actually explain as well, just quickly, that Russell over NASDAQ ratio, why you look at that fundamentally?
Well, the technology growth stocks are really looking at their earnings forward, and they're discounting the present value of all future earnings and growth, and that's done so at a yield or an interest rate level. And so what happens is that therefore when you have a deflationary impulse that we have seen over the last several years, that actually, just the way treasury bonds were rallying in that period, that actually acts as a tailwind, allowing growth stocks to outperform and do incredibly well in those periods. And and so when you have steepening and rising interest rates, it usually acts as a drag for that growth story. And that's where value and small cap and cyclicals and particularly deep value cyclicals and commodity cycle stories can all really start to work. And so that's that rotation is one of the big things to identify in portfolio construction right now.
And the Russell NASDAQ is, the Russell's like a small cap index, and the NASDAQ's very tech heavy. So it's not like a perfect, here's a perfect growth and a perfect small cap or perfect growth and perfect value, but it's a pretty good indicator. And you'll see the same things on across the other.
You could also just take
that's the what it's trying to represent.
Yeah, and you could do the same thing by just doing the ETF VLUE, the value divided by momentum MTUM, which is the two ETFs in the U.S. that directly on the basket. So I chose Russell NASDAQ, but there are different ways of getting very similar charts, to capture that rotation.
So I guess what I'm saying is, if we thought this was going to be a real recovery and we didn't have this big debt overhang and we were off to the races now for a recovery, I guess what I'm thinking is this twos, tens yield curve would top out at back at, say, 2.5%. Whereas if we're thinking it's not a real recovery, or we're thinking that markets will actually get concerned if interest rates rise because it'll actually start causing economic problems without having the liquidity out there, I guess how high can you see this running before markets actually start thinking of that steepness as being a negative rather than as a positive?
Well, I think that generally yields can gravitate back to their pre-coronavirus levels. So, you know, that's the 160 to 2% range. But if it did so gradually, I think the market could absorb it. Really, it's all about the rate of change. If there was an event that caused yields to rapidly start rising, that's where the it could create short-term instability. And so I think that it's very much a rate of change story more than a particular level on the yields. It's sort of like that boiling a frog type of analogy that, that you know, if they if it just gradually is crawling higher, the market will find a way to absorb it. The bigger question is you know, the Democrats have a pretty big agenda in terms of infrastructure spending, and they're going to be running pretty substantial deficits, and they're going to need to have a certain amount of access to the treasury markets to be able to do the spending that they want, even if there is some version of some MMT kind of thing that inevitably emerges. But keeping a liquid treasury bond market that is going to be really important. And so this is where it'll be really interesting to see what levels we start seeing some form of yield curve control that comes in. I can't imagine them allowing this to steepen very high before we start hearing central banks trying to talk it down. I think they'll just threaten yield curve control. I don't think they'll even do it, but just them talking about it will have the market be forced to start pricing it in, right?
Mm. And having Janet Yellen there as Treasury Secretary, obviously you'd think they'll be working a lot closer between the Biden administration.
I'll let my my co-host Kevin Muir kind of give you the fill-in on that one. He obviously with the MMT and all the other things like that, there's all sorts of storylines in that. I'm more of a trader, and it's more about the trends and the impact on the markets that influence the types of trades I'm publishing and what I'm looking for in the markets versus the really deep dive macro into understanding, you know, how we transition into that new kind of world where central banks and governments work or in Treasury Department work hand in hand together to allow these governments to do such huge fiscal spends without there being consequences in the bond markets.
Yes. Yeah, but I guess it's the thought I've got anyway is that it's less likely to be played out in public between, you know, a president haranguing his central bank to do things, and it's more likely to be a central banker who's in government, who former head of the Fed, who's now in government, who's actually got knows which levers to pull if she wants to get the Fed to sort of
I'm sure it's going to be a lot quieter. There isn't going to be I don't think there's going to be a Biden and Yellen Twitter handle that's going to be smack talking the Fed.
Yes, I think.
I think it'll take a little more.
Yes. Okay, so we probably should do the dollar before we get off bond yields and onto industrial metals. The US dollar, obviously, that's a pretty central to any asset allocation, and that's been relatively weak recently. If you don't want to buy the dollar, besides buying the Canadian dollar or the Aussie dollar, but if you want a big currency, you really need euro, pound, or Japanese yen. I guess what are your thoughts on, are there any one of those in particular you like better, or are you expecting a US dollar reversal?
Well, I think that there's a reason that US dollar has been in a downtrend, and there's a fundamental backdrop behind it. And I don't think that I'm willing to stick my neck out to say that that the dollar downtrend is over. But the whole anchor behind the reflation trade in the way that I approach macro at big picture trading, the dollar is the pivotal asset that everything the reflation trade anchors off of, and so the dollar has become such a consensus trade on the downside, everyone anticipating the US dollar to continue to weaken, that we have reached some extreme sentiment on that front. And on page eight, I have that chart showing just the commitment of traders reports being at extreme levels on a 5-year percentile basis. Now, obviously, currency using commitment of trader reports on currencies has some shortcomings because the market is so big, but it just really is a good gauge as to how negative the sentiment has become. And whenever you have this huge amount of crowding in a currency position, there's always room for the counter trend short squeezes to inevitably occur. And I think that as we approach those 2008 levels on the dollar index, we are in a position where there could be a squeeze to the upside on the dollar, and to wash out all the weak hands that are joining the party a little late. I don't think that I would be looking for a new U.S. dollar bull phase, but if we could easily go through a 1-month period where we grab 3 to 5 Dixie handles on the upside and just really wash everything out and throw a bucket of cold water on the short term on the reflation trade, that probably will be an epic buying opportunity on many fronts, because I don't think that would be a new macro long-term trend, but rather just stating how we are very oversold on the dollar and very overbought on all the periphery trades benefiting from that reflation impulse that has come on the back of that.
Well, just a question from me quickly there, Patrick. If we do see that rally in the US dollar, what do you think that impact will have on the stock market, if any?
The first part is kind of a following a chain reaction, which is I think that the most direct impact on a dollar rally would come through the commodity markets, which we're going to be talking about shortly. And I think that a lot of these deep value cyclical commodity plays that have just become incredibly hot and overextended would immediately have mean reversions kicking in. Now, that again, I still think that would be a buying opportunity in the bigger picture, but it would immediately cause that part of the market to have the first impact. But it would certainly immediately back off yields and all of the things that have been working in the last 2 months that have been driving this trend will just do what the markets always do. The markets always move in ebb and flow like waves. And once we see the dollar have any squeeze, it's going to have that chain reaction in all of the secondary markets. And I think that too many people are too overextended and too long, and there's a risk that there's going to be a little bit of a washout on these trades, particularly those that have been getting in just in the last couple of weeks that have been just chasing this pure momentum, and they're likely to get washed out when we see a dollar squeeze ensue.
So then it sounds like you're expecting an increase in volatility over the short term. Is that right?
It is definitely the risk. You never know for sure, but volatility, I guess, as measured by something like the VIX, which is the way it's being priced into the option markets. But I would argue that when you're seeing many of these like resource stocks ripping to the upside at the velocity they have, I think volatility is already here. It's the volatility to the upside, which no one's going to complain about.
Absolutely, yeah.
No one ever complains about making too much money too quickly. But usually that's what creates that overheated market. Now we'll have the volatility mean revert the other way. And usually there is a direct relationship with the velocity of which the rise occurs. We'll have often the correction that comes on the other side. It has a direct the magnitude of the correction has a direct correlation to the speed of which the rise occurred in the first place. And this is where everything from Tesla to Bitcoin to whether it's a Freeport McMoRan or BHP Billiton or any of these resource stocks like US Steel that have just been running, all of these at some point are going to pause and mean revert.
Okay, so maybe before we go into commodities, just a couple more questions elaborating on the volatility in the US dollar. So this is a question we've got on YouTube from one of the listeners. They're asking whether or not we'll see a return to the cheap volatility that we saw between 2012 and 2018, or whether you think that VIX above 20 is the new normal for volatility in the short to midterm.
I think that VIX above 20 is going to be with us on the most immediate term, like intermediate term. So I feel that if we were heading below 20, it would have already happened on the short term. But what drives lower volatility, there was a short gamma regime that existed with a lot of call overwriting and all sorts of things that suppressed volatility in the prior years. And once this crash occurred, it basically has kind of had everyone reevaluate how they approach selling premium or what risk has to be priced into their models. And so we're in a period where there's so much uncertainty in this COVID period where I can't imagine volatility and coming back down to, let's say, a 12 handle on the VIX on the short term. I do believe that a year or two out, it's entirely possible. But I think that if you're putting on that trade right now, anticipating the next 2 months to seeing that 20 handle broken, I wouldn't hold. I don't think we'll see it. It would have already happened in my mind if it was destined to be.
Okay. And quickly, do you look at the Aussie dollar and do you have a view on if the US dollar rallies like you think it could do, what that might mean for the Aussie dollar out to the middle or the end of this year?
Right. So I think the Aussie dollar can be basketed with almost with even the Canadian dollar or even some of the more emerging market style commodity based currencies like the Brazilian real or the South African rand. Like during this commodity impulse, these are all of our currencies really impulse higher in the period where the US dollar was weak. I am still in the camp that we are in a commodity bull market. And even though I think there's room for all of these things to correct, I'm still in the camp that any correction should be bought on dip and that some new multi-year bull market in commodities is here. And it is going to continue to strengthen these commodity-based currencies over, let's say, a 2 to 3 year period. But whether you're looking at the Aussie or the CAD currencies right now, the Aussie dollar went from its lows of 55 cents up to 78. Right, it's there's a point where it's run. It's overextended on one impulse move. I think that we could easily see short-term pullbacks during that scenario that I described where, you know, it could easily come back to 74, 75 cents, but I would be buying the dip on it if it was. So I'm not bearish the Aussie, but it certainly, I think, is overdone on it from a trading perspective. This is not a tactical asymmetric moment to be adding to that trade.
And in terms of the Aussie dollar, Canadian dollar, because I guess we sort of look at things, and I guess you guys are in Canada, it's similar that you get to use international equities as a bit of a hedge in terms of it. Yeah. If things are going great, then the Aussie dollar is going up, and international equities are going up, and so your Aussie dollar sort of brings off, sort of reduces your international equities performance. But when it flips around, the Aussie dollar often falls, and it actually helps to dampen your losses.
Yes.
If we're, as Australian investors, if we're looking at Canada and saying, well, if I'm picking Canadian stocks to invest in that are largely domestic, are there any with a view that, look, the Aussie dollar, Canadian dollar cross is probably going to be relatively similar, and so I won't have that hedge as much in place. is there any other issues you can see with that Aussie dollar, Canadian dollar cross that we should be worried about?
I think the biggest variable that could cause them to diverge is the difference in even though we're two very commodity based currencies, the Canadian one has a strong oil component to it, and the trend in crude oil prices I think may influence a divergence between the two. If oil was to get very bullish, then it could drive a relative Canadian dollar outperformance. But overall, I think that on a much bigger scale, it's more important to call the US dollar move, and that the CAD and the Aussie are likely to be correlated. And so, I mean, I think it's more splitting hairs. I don't think you're going to create too much alpha and trying to nitpick between it. It's really whether you get the US dollar trade right, and if whether you're in the Aussie or the CAD. I think if you get the dollar call right, you're not going to see too much of a difference to your portfolio, whichever the two you choose.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, so that's probably a good lead in then maybe to some of the oil side. I'll sort of probably try and split your commodity positive view into, I don't know if there's three parts, the oil side, the metal side, and then maybe the soft commodities as a last if we need to go there. So the oil, from our perspective, we're sort of looking at both demand and supply, and just sort of feeling as if it seems to be very uncertain in both cases. So on the supply side, there's obviously a lot of production coming offline, and not as much CapEx going on, and particularly in the US shale where you've got quite steep decline rates. But on the flip, and then you have OPEC holding supply off market, which how much of that they can quickly bring back on, who knows. And then on the demand side, though, we don't know, are people going to travel a lot less in general under the new scenario? So there's actually going to be weak demand because there's more people working from home, or is that going to be offset by fewer people taking public transport and international travel? We don't know if that coming or going. It just seems as to be extremely uncertain. Have you got any sort of feedback for us on that? And do you think that just means that it's more risky now, or are these sort of the risks all sort of cancelling each other out? And so sort of upside risk in supply versus downside risk in demand sort of cancels out and creates more of an even sort of distribution for outcomes.
Well, I've had the opportunity to co-host Macro Voices, where Eric has been an oil hedge fund manager for years, and he brings on Art Berman, an oil geologist, and they go into extraordinary depths to kind of understand those very things that you're talking about. And what I have found over that time period is that overanalyzing that, there's a self-correcting mechanism that happens that has a reaction function where if it kind of gets out of whack on one side, then OPEC steps in and it goes back and forth, and they're always finding some way of kind of finding that equilibrium point. The bigger question in my mind is that the reflation trade anchors off of oil. Oil is the largest commodity by a long shot. I always love that visual capitalist chart where they basically put all of the value of all basic materials in a bubble of how big the multi-trillion dollar crude oil market is, and just really shows you how big and how important crude is to the reflation trade. And I think that the correlation of oil to inflation is very evident. And so if one subscribes to this view that we got a weak dollar and inflation is coming, that is, it would be very hard to see inflation risks being very huge without crude oil prices substantially rising. And that's not necessarily my forecast, but but if you subscribe to the reflation trade, then higher oil prices would be something that would have to be a byproduct of that. And so I personally am somewhat bullish oil. I feel that that washout to minus $40 a barrel constitutes pretty much a bottom. I don't know whether you can make a lower low below minus $40 in a barrel, right? I think we can comfortably say that there was a bottom put in. The one thing that really did impress me was the fact that there was so many reasons back in the summer for crude oil to sell off again. And really, even though we got down into the mid 30s, there was a substantial basing period where oil stabilized, and when it's stable for an extended period of time, like 3, 4, 5, 6 months, all global participants start to adapt their models and adjust everything to that new period of. And so I feel that generally. It is very unloved. There is no new money flowing for new exploration projects and all sorts. And it's I feel that there is going to be a strong inflationary impulse from a bull market in crude oil. But, and there's the but, I think just very similar to the narrative you heard me talk about in the stock markets and on the dollar. I think that as we approach this mid-50s level on crude, there's lots of room for the short-term bullish impulse to have worked itself out. And we could enter a period where for even multiple months, oil is going to be correcting and backfilling. But I don't think that we're going to see crude oil go anywhere back really below 40. Maybe we can go into the mid 40s during a correction, but I think that that the bear market is really over, and even if there was a correction in crude, it would be just an opportunity to be buying the dip on many of these stocks and the commodity.
Excellent. Well, I want to make sure as well, because I know that we're running short of time now. I want to make sure we get through it all. I want to get to some of your diversification versus hedging. So let's do the metals, because that's obviously near and dear to Aussie's hearts, with such a huge exposure to iron ore in particular. Yeah, I guess that. So you've got your thoughts there, but I guess. I just wanted to fall on the we see those metals as being basically, in particular iron ore, very much so, is being wholly China dependent, and it basically doesn't matter. You know, if you said to me that demand in Europe, for example, was spiking for iron ore, but it was marginally down in China, I'd be saying, well, the marginally down in China is what matters. It's not the spike in Europe. I don't know do you see this in a similar way, or how are you looking at the metals market and the positivity?
Well, China is a huge consumer of iron ore, and that's always going to be the case, and particularly since Australia is the primary. Your primary customer is just north of you, right? And so that is something that's evident there. But I think what the bigger picture that has to be looked at in industrial metals, whether copper or any of the you can get into lithium and all the other things. What we're continuing to see is we had this economic devastation that's being caused by COVID. And just like what you're seeing in US politics with the Democrats coming in and big new infrastructure spends coming, I think that the whole world, the governments are going to need to spend to restart everything on an economic level, because the stock market level has been doing fine, but the economies still need a proper kickstart, and there's going to be huge infrastructure spending. And I think that that almost all industrial and basic materials are going to be increasingly in demand. I'm very bullish this entire space, and I won't disagree that China plays an important role, but I think that it's going to be a very broad global increase in demand in all of these. And of course, when you get to things like lithium and copper, their demand is a lot driven by things like the growing demand for electric cars and infrastructure needed for the new electrical grids. There's so many different things, applications beyond that, but I'm very bullish them. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but that's been such a hot market, and it's quite overbought. So it's really one of those things where you have to be very careful about getting excited about it if you're brand new coming in listening to, let's say, this podcast that, oh, I'm going to go and buy some here after, you know, BHP, Rio Tinto, and Vale have had these huge runs. This is not necessarily an asymmetric moment to start your new buying operation.
Then, did you want to talk the soft commodities, the lumber, or... Is that maybe just really quickly on that one, and then because
switch. Overall, all commodities have been doing very well there, but it's all a part of that bigger reflation trade. What I'm going to be saying would be just really echoing very similar view. I think as soon as the U.S. dollar puts a short-term bottom, many of these are going to go through one of the typical 1 to 2 month corrections. And when we see that those corrections happen and the mean reversions happen, I still think there'll be a compelling buy on dip, and I think we can leave it at that.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, well, John, maybe let's jump to the some of the options for risk management and your sort of alternatives to diversification. This is sort of your day job.
Right. And you yourself are managing money, and it's one of the diversification is something that is the most widely accepted way of managing risk. And rightfully so, when you're managing very large sums of money, there aren't always many alternatives to diversification. But one of the really interesting things is that when you educate yourself on the utilization of options, you have all sorts of different alternative ways to manage risk, which therefore allow you to be able to create all sorts of great trading opportunities, managing risk and not having to diversification has this huge advantage. Of managing risk, what it also does do is it dilutes any chance of you making extraordinary gains, because you've diluted your concentration into opportunities that actually can make big returns when you're trying to own all sorts of uncorrelated assets. And what we can do, and what I love to do, is to come up with great themes and ideas and construct option strategies around them to actually build the asymmetry in there, and we can do so with very strong concentrated positions. One area where I see that extraordinary opportunity is in the gold market, and I'd love to give an example of that. If you look on page 16, which is showing the volatility surface of the S&P 500 using the options. And you see the fat left tail element, which is that the cost of buying put insurance on the downside of markets is extraordinarily expensive. And as you're buying calls or selling calls out of the money, volatility is much lower. And the premiums are much cheaper, and this creates.
And actually, sorry, Patrick, can I just give one quick one, just for anyone who's struggling to follow this one? what Patrick's talking about with the volatility is the cost of buying volatility. So basically, yes. it's a measure which you use in terms of option pricing. You basically, rather than putting it in terms of a price, you actually say, well, what volatility does that imply if I'm going to pay that price? And that gives you a much better feel for the normal volatility of the market, which is sort of 15 to 20%, and then how much you have to pay to actually hedge yourself against the market moves for that. Sorry.
Right. And so typically something like the S&P 500 to do a risk reversal where you basically sell a covered call and use the proceeds to buy a protective put, you'll almost never find an opportunity where you'll have more upside and less downside risk and at a zero cost. But what's particularly fascinating about the gold market, and looking at page 17, is that you have this really nice U-shaped volatility surface, which basically means call options pay very lucrative premium returns in the gold market. And what this allows you to do is build all sorts of strategies to be able to hedge it out. So now, for all the complexity, let me just illustrate an example with a real example. If one was to today, for instance, buy the GLD using the gold ETF, you could buy a protective put a 5% lower and sell a covered call 10% higher for almost zero cost. And you build an asymmetric trade where you basically have less, only 5% risk on the downside of being long gold while having 10% upside. And in doing so, with almost no carry costs, you've created a situation where you have a very limited risk. And so you could take a very concentrated position in that. And so long as you're comfortable with that 5% downside when you're constructing your trade, one could do a position, a very concentrated position. You know, even I would like, I don't want to specify, let's say half of your portfolio is in there. As long as you are comfortable with a 5% downside risk in your as a trader in the way you model your risk and the way you manage your trades, you can put on this trade in a concentrated manner and be able to profit from a gold move. And so there's all these amazing strategies that are out there that you can build and that allow you to have these concentrated positions and take very high conviction trades in the favorite things that you believe will work.
Mm. And actually, and I'll give you the plug because we're winding up for Patrick's own service. And I think that's one example, but Patrick's often got other examples and they should change from time to time in terms of saying, well, if you want to protect your, you know, if you're worried about the markets topping out here and you want to protect your portfolio, sometimes it's put options, sometimes there's other different strategies you can use. And it sort of, because these implied volatilities are moving around all the time, the best possible strategy is always changing. And that's what Patrick's doing from day to day. So, highly recommend people listening or having a look at your service. Is there anything else that you wanted to run through on? Today, I know we've covered a lot and we've missed a lot of because there's so much. It's a big world. But is there anything else that sort of
I think we covered a lot already and for one session. But always happy to continue the conversation in the future.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure if Patrick has to go, Damien. Definitely want to throw to you in a minute to talk about some of this stuff and how you're thinking about it in terms of the portfolio. But Patrick, also, we've got your details up there on the screen now. But can people follow you on Twitter? And obviously there's the podcast we talk about at the start. How else or are there any other ways that people can follow you or get in touch with your work?
Well, I have the membership at bigpicturetrading.com. We have a free trial that you can access without any credit card, and we have we just recently did a great a webinar on tactically trading this commodity cycle, and the use of options on it is completely free for anyone that signs up for the trial. So you can follow me on Twitter at Patrick Ceresna. As well, you can listen to us on the podcast at the Market Huddle and Macro Voices. So that's where people can find me.
Excellent. Thank you. And I actually have a question about big picture trading. How much do you need to know about options to be able to utilize that membership?
Well, our analysis always starts at the top level. So we're analyzing all of the macro markets and individual stocks and securities. Options are simply a resource we use to construct the tactical trades. And one could take the trades just directly with the equities, or you could add the option overlays So you can start off at a very simple level, and you could take it to the more sophisticated level. We have all sorts of great educational content on there to help bring everyone's level of education up to being able to follow along what we're doing.
Excellent. So anyone out there who wasn't quite sure when Patrick was talking about gamma and volatility surfaces, now you know where you can go to get those questions answered.
No, thank you.
Thanks very much for being on the show, Patrick. So I'm going to hand over to Damien now. Patrick, more than welcome to hang around, but if you have somewhere you need to be, thank you again. Damien, can you run us through the portfolio and how some of the stuff that we're talking about is, I guess, being reflected there or in your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I think it's probably relatively clear that I think Patrick and I are looking at the markets and certainly the macro side of it relatively similarly at the moment. For me, it's all about getting as much exposure as you dare and trying to keep an eye on the factors that are going to drive it down. Sorry. The main thing I guess I'm sort of following from Patrick's is that there are a number of short-term issues you should be watching and a number of markets that have run extended a bit too far. And so piling into the trades right now, is, I guess, the message certainly loud and clear from Patrick is it might not be the best time, but looking for these trends to continue absent some other bigger macro negative effects is really what we're going to be really focused on over the coming months. So it's that, yeah, get as much exposure as you dare and have a very close eye on some of these the early warning signs and the canaries that we'll be following. And we've got a list of those, a lot of those positive and negative factors up on the screen at the moment.
Fantastic. I love that line, get as much exposure as you dare. And so maybe I will go to, I guess, close off the show. But before I do that, want to introduce our viewer question of the week. We'd love to hear your thoughts on will liquidity be more important than fundamentals in 2021? Post those up in the YouTube chat and let us know what you think. So I hope you've enjoyed today's show. And if you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. You can also stay up to date with Nucleus Wealth news by following us on social media. And we'd love to hear your comments or suggestions for future webinar topics. So go ahead and post those in the comments section of this YouTube video if you have any. And lastly, if you have a friend, family member, or workmate who you think would get something out of today's show, please share it with them and help our podcast grow.